This is Jim Inkster. Coming next on the show, we'll visit with a gentleman named Tom North. His book is True North, The Shocking Truth About Yours, Mine, and Ours. Remember the movie with Lucille Ball and Henry Fonda? The film was about two families that were blended together and is based on the family that Tom North was a part of. And he says there was child abuse. And we're talking with him about his experience and about the allegations against filmmaker Woody Allen. Tom North, coming soon. Also, Grace Boatwright, she's with a group called the National Grange with some innovative concepts regarding agriculture in the world, particularly rural areas of the United States and in Louisiana. And now we'll pause for the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 877-217-5757, wherever you may be, and 297-5633 if you're calling locally. The email address is inkstershow@wrkf.org. Remember the 1968 film, Yours, Mine, and Ours? Some of us are old enough to remember that. Lucille Ball and Henry Fonda playing a couple that gets together with families from previous relationships. And the loving family portrayed in the film has been embraced to the point where there was even a remake of the movie. But it differs dramatically from the actual Beardsley family. And Tom North is here to share what it was like to grow up in that family. Good morning, Tom North, the author of True North, The Shocking Truth About Yours, Mine, and Ours.
Good morning, Jim.
Nice to talk with you. And this is a serious subject and one that is such that many times people are reluctant to talk about it. But we're opening some wounds for you, I'm sure. But you have decided to do so by virtue of writing your book. It took a while to do so. How much thought was there into going back and reliving this past?
Oh, that's a great question. There was only about 20 years of thought that went into the writing of this book. I put it off and put it off, but eventually it became a very important topic, and so I wrote the book. Basically, I began writing the book in 2008 and finished it in 2010, but then I rewrote it again in 2012, and so here we are.
You had a very big family.
Well, there were 20 children eventually, and to summarize what you just mentioned, Mr. Beardsley had 10 children, and Mrs. North had 8 children. That's 18. They got married, and they had 2 more.
20 kids. That's a lot of kids, and all living in the same house at the same time?
For a short period of time, yes.
So, on the surface, this was an idyllic match of two beautiful families, a handsome couple, but you say there was a cruel truth and revelation behind the facade that the world saw in the movie Yours, Mine, and Ours.
Yes, you know, a little history is helpful there. Lucille Ball saw the story in the newspapers because it was a human interest story at the time. And so she called my mother and stepfather and said, I want to make a movie, keeping in mind that this was the early 1960s, which was the time of sitcoms about white suburban families like Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet and Father Knows Best and so on. And so what Lucy wanted to do was make the great American sitcom. And so she did and called it Yours, Mine, and Ours. And it was funny, and it was heartwarming, and it was entertaining, but it was anything but the truth.
What was the truth?
The truth was is that Frank Beardsley was psychotic, and he was dangerous to be around. And so we children made every effort to not be around if he was in the room. And so what happened is that my mother married him basically to save his children. she saw 10 children living in terror for their lives, and she thought, oh, my God, I can't abandon these children to this man, because she was afraid he was going to kill them. And so she figured, being the good Irish Catholic martyr that she was, she said, I'll marry him, and then I'll save his children from him, and I'll save him from himself. Well, that doesn't always work out.
How old were you, Tom, when your mother and your stepfather married?
I was 7. My father, Dick North, Richard North, was a Navy aviator, and he was killed flying experimental aircraft for the Navy. And when he died, within 15 months, my mother had married Mr. Beardsley, and I was 7 years old.
And you say Mr. Beardsley was psychotic, and that evidenced itself in many ways, and I suspect that all child abusers are not psychotic, but there was plenty of that, wasn't there?
Well, there was. He was an equal opportunity abuser. He abused both his adopted family, his adopted children, and his own children. And so we just tried to be absent when he was around. We never knew when he was going to go off or who his next victim was going to be.
So he had 20 kids in the house, of various ages. You were 7 years old. Were you personally abused by him?
Well, we were all abused by him. He was a very dangerous, as I say, a very dangerous person to be around. And it would be very normal to come around the corner, run into him in the hallway, and be knocked across the room with the back of his hand. And when I would get up and say, what was that for? He would say, just for drill.
Mm-hmm. Was there sexual abuse?
There was sexual abuse. In the words of my younger sister, he was an ultra-violent, alcoholic, misogynistic pedophile. And so he was predatory in all respects. And in fact, at one point, he tried to engage me in sexual activity, and I saw what was coming and just bolted. I wanted out of there as fast as I could get it. Mm-hmm. Get out.
Did your mother know of this?
Well, she knew and didn't know what to do about it, and she went into denial. And she attempted to ignore it. And eventually, her good intentions to save his children, as the years went on and fatigue set in, and she simply got tired of trying to protect the children, she eventually began feeding the children to him to protect herself.
How long did the marriage last?
The marriage, interesting question. The marriage actually lasted for almost 30 years. She married him in 1961, and in 1990, she left him because her health was failing, and she realized that it was the toxic relationship with Frank Beardsley that was killing her. And so she left him and spent the next 10 years of her life. She passed in 2000, but she spent the next 10 years on her own.
And what happened to Frank Beardsley?
Well, Frank Beardsley passed away just a little more than a year ago, in December of 2012, at the age of 97.
97. So despite what you claim, he apparently didn't have any health effects from his actions.
Well, I have to say that longevity was in his genetic history. He had 2 sisters who died at 104 and 105, and there are several of his siblings who are still alive, and he was the second youngest.
Did he ever show any remorse?
He did. It's a good question, Jim. As I state in the book, during the 1990s, it was 1989, I took the family through therapy. So we had group therapy for most of the group. And during that therapy session, he did apologize for his behavior, but it didn't stick.
Why not?
Well, there's a, you know, he had pre-existing behavior patterns that reasserted themselves. And so as much as he did apologize, and at that time I took the opportunity to forgive him. It was a very dramatic experience, and I chronicled it in the chapters called the Demise of Grendel, which is a chapter later, just chapter 27 of the book. And so he did apologize. What happened is we kind of backed him into a corner, and he was either going to take responsibility for his behavior or my mother was going to take responsibility for his behavior. And so he stepped up and said, wait a minute, it wasn't her fault, it was mine, I did it. And so it was a very interesting dynamic. And I talk about it in the book in chapter 27.
All right. Well, you have become active on this issue beyond the book. And you say that there are traits that child abusers, sexual pedophiles, that most have in common. What are those traits?
So those traits are generally a history in their own background of child abuse. This is very often a generational pattern. Which is carried on generation after generation, and it certainly was the case in the Beardsley family. I talk about that in the book, about his history and what made him the person that he was. But pedophiles and child abusers have often been abused themselves, and they don't know what to do with the rage that they carry deep within their own subconscious. And so it's common for them to act out that rage on others.
Well, this subject gained new attention over the weekend. An open letter by Dylan Farrow, Woody Allen's adopted daughter, was published Sunday in the New York Times. And in the letter, Ms. Farrow presented graphic details in her account of sexual abuse. She says happened when she was a child by Mr. Allen. What do you make of this?
Well, I haven't read the open letter. I have seen a couple of headlines in the papers, but I haven't read the articles, so I don't have enough information to comment. But I know that, you know, unfortunately, there is a principle at work in our culture, and actually it's sort of a principle, a natural principle of the universe called Pareto's principle, and we know it as the 80-20 rule. And it says that 80% of the energy in a system is generated by 20% of the units, and it has to do with people as well. In a work situation, 80% of the work gets done by 20% of the people. And unfortunately, as it relates to our topic, 80% of the families in America are dysfunctional, and it has a lot to do with child abuse and simply poor parenting. So we find that principle carries through. So if Woody Allen is one of those 80% of the dysfunctional people, then that's not surprising.
It would seem difficult, not impossible, but difficult for somebody in the public eye like Mr. Allen, who is now 78 years old, to have engaged in this kind of activity and with another public person, a family with Mia Farrow, and not have been exposed before now. And there were allegations more than 20 years ago, but they kind of went away. Of course, the child was quite young then. What is the difficulty in exposing this kind of behavior?
Well, there are quite a few difficulties, not the least of which is that society just does not want to look at this issue at all. We want to see the positive side, the sunny side. We all want to be, in a sense, Pollyannas and look at everything in a bright perspective. And there's nothing wrong with that as long as we're willing to
all right, hold tight. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. In our remaining time with Tom North, his book is True North, The Shocking Truth About Yours, Mine, and Ours. The film in the late 1960s, 1968, with Lucille Ball and Henry Fonda, about a blended family, kind of a precursor to the Brady Bunch. And Tom North was a member of that family and says the father, Mr. Beardsley, was a pedophile and abused his children, and there were 20 people in the house. So if you'd like to comment, please give us a call, 877-217-5757 or 297-5633. Those are your numbers. And JC, I think we lost Mr. North briefly, but that may be him on the line right now. So it is a difficult subject, and one that has been reopened with the allegations against filmmaker Woody Allen, who has made some of the finest movies of all time, nominated for an Oscar for the best original screenplay for Blue Jasmine this year. He'll be 79 on December 1st. If he is innocent, this is certainly not fair. If he is guilty, it's what took so long. And before we hit the break, Tom North was discussing the difficulty in people coming forward about these kinds of cases, and we saw it with Jerry Sandusky and many others, pedophiles who did their thing for a long time before they were caught. And I didn't intend to interrupt your statement, but we had some business to take care of. What about the challenges that are involved in coming forward with allegations of these kind?
Well, the allegations are often hard to prove. There's a whole segment of my family that does not want to acknowledge the behavior of Frank Beardsley, and they want to support the fantasy of the Yours, Mine, and Ours story created by Lucille Ball. And of course, that's a pattern that was established a long time ago. So there's a history in most families of denial, and that's hard to overcome. There's also a social stigma around aberrant behavior that society just doesn't want to acknowledge. And so these are just some of the difficulties of dealing with this kind of behavior.
But in the case, let's say, of Woody Allen, there's a chance that he is innocent of this, that this is something that is not true. And if that's the case, then he is a victim. And just the allegation is such that his reputation will be tarnished forever.
Correct.
So that is a concern, that once something like this gets in the public domain, people, rightly or wrongly, will always suspect Woody Allen of abusing one of his children.
Right. Right. So it does create issues. And again, this is so many years later, this is an allegation that's very difficult to prove. Now, child abusers seldom have one victim. And so if there were other people who came forward and said, "Well, Mr. Allen abused me too," well, then there would be additional corroboration for those allegations. In my family, there are quite a few of us who have said, yes, Tom North's book is accurate, and in fact, that abuse did take place. And five of my family have come forward and said, yes, those Tom North's book is accurate. And then there's a whole section, and the entire Beardsley side of the family has said, no, this is nothing true about this at all, and he's full of malarkey.
Okay. Well, people who have a history like this, can they help others?
Well, and again, this is the key is that there's a whole organization, a nationwide organization called CASA, which C-A-S-A It's court-appointed special advocates for children.
And there is a chapter here in Baton Rouge that is quite
vibrant. And I don't know how much time we have, Jim, but in your area, there is the Capital Area CASA Association. Mm-hmm. And their goal is to provide a volunteer advocate for every child in East Baton Rouge Parish who needs a voice. And I sure wish that CASA existed when I was growing up. It didn't exist at that time. And the social environment was such that if I had raised my voice, I would have been silenced. Because no one wants to think of a celebrity like Frank Beardsley as being a child molester. But that's what he was.
This kind of thing happens in all kinds of families, rich and poor, white and black. I recall several years ago interviewing Michael Reagan, the son of Ronald Reagan, and he said he was abused as a child, not by anybody in his immediate family, but by somebody else, and that this went on, and it didn't stop until it affected him in an immense way, and I think one time is enough to change the course of somebody's life.
It really is, and it's a very difficult thing for people to integrate into their experience because they feel that they must have done something wrong to have deserved to be abused this way, and really, it's not their fault at all. It's an unfortunate event, and you know we all wish it didn't exist, but it does, and so. Fortunately, we have organizations like CASA that step forward and say, okay, we're going to give children a voice. In fact, interested listeners that you have could visit www.casabr.org.
Okay.
Or they could call 255-379-8598 for more information or if they wanted to become a child advocate.
CASA.org. Now, you say Frank Beardsley died at 97, Tom, last
year. Yes, he died at the age of 97, and he was, again, as I mentioned, he had longevity in his genetic makeup.
Well, do you wish you had written this book 10 years ago?
Well, you know, it was interesting. Over the years, I would share the story with people at social gatherings if it was appropriate. And several people came back to me and said, you know, based on what you shared with me, I went and addressed issues in my own family, and I got resolution, so thank you for sharing that story with me. And so I thought, well, maybe there is a broader audience for this. And I don't think I was ready 10 years ago to write this story. I've been in therapy my whole life, and so I have been working on these issues and trying to root out the poor software and the poor programming in my own unconscious. And so it was only in 2008 that I was able to get the courage to write this book.
We thank you for joining us today. Tom North and his book is True North, The Shocking Truth About Yours, Mine, and Ours. Appreciate your comments today, Tom.
Thank you for having me on your show, Jim.
Take care, and good luck to you.
Thanks.
We're joined now by Grace Boatwright. She is with the National Grange, a family community organization with roots in agriculture, founded in 1867. It was formed as a national organization with a local focus, and it has, from the start, included women who have been equal members since the inception of the Grange. And good morning to you, Grace Boatwright.
Good morning to you.
Nice to talk with you, and how did you become involved?
How did I become involved in Grange? I moved up to Washington, D.C. about 4 years ago, and pretty much just answered an ad in the paper, and here I was.
What are the major issues that you were focusing upon today?
Well, we're definitely still celebrating Farm Bill passage from a few days ago.
Right.
I'd say I'm pretty heavily involved in rural broadband expansion. We're doing some rural health care issues. Farm Bill implementation will be something to consume a lot of time in the following months.
Okay, well, The rural broadband expansion, which was rejected by our governor, about $80 million that would have come our way. What is the benefit of this?
Benefit of expanding rural broadband?
Yes.
Well, basically, the ultimate goal is to get rural Americans the same resources they require to succeed in business and stay competitive in the global economy as all of their urban counterparts are already enjoying.
Well, I don't think Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, was the only governor to reject it, but he got some criticism, and then the story kind of went away. But do you think that this is something that is vital to these particular areas that would have received the federal money?
Absolutely. I mean, you can't run a business without Internet anymore. You can't do just about anything. And if they had access to high-speed broadband, they could have the same kind of accounting services and legal services, banking services, using GPS, you know, out in the fields. I mean, the uses for this technology are just endless.
And farming has become high-tech, hasn't it?
Very high-tech. Very high-tech. Someone told me a joke a while back about how this guy got his Cadillac in a ditch, and when a farmer stopped to try to help him, the guy said, "You're not really going to hook that thing up to my $50,000 car, are you?" And the farmer said, "No, I wouldn't dream of hooking my $250,000 tractor up to your $50,000 car."
Well,
that's
yeah.
That's just about how high-tech it can be.
Yeah, people don't realize those tractors are they're expensive machines, and farmers, for good reason, protect them with their lives. But in rural Louisiana, many communities would have benefited from this broadband program, a federal program. And what are some of the success stories that you've heard in other places?
Well, one of the bigger legislative accomplishments I think we've had in recent years is getting the Universal Service Fund monies to be used for broadband expansion instead of traditional landline services, because that opened up a lot of money for better use. And I think that even just private companies like Verizon and AT&T and other smaller carriers that are now taking the initiative to expand out to these areas where it wasn't economically beneficial before, but they realize that it's required resource now. We just can't live without it.
297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757 for Grace Boatwright of the National Grange. And your title is Legislative Director, is that correct?
That's right.
All right. Bren in Denham Springs. Bren, you're on with Grace Boatwright.
Hi, good morning. I just had a question. Forgive my ignorance, but why is it the responsibility of the government to expand out into the rural areas and not the private market? And I'll take my answer off there.
Well, the government sees the necessity, whereas private companies, they don't really see the economic benefit for having spent all the money to expand out to a rural area where maybe only 10 people can actually purchase their service. So the government's long ago, even before we had Internet, the government took it upon themselves to expand telephone service using the Universal Service Fund. But I think that that's slowly changing, and I think we're actually making great strides in this area, and I think most of these rural areas will enjoy Internet in, I'd say, less than 15 years.
Well, for those areas that did not get the federal infusion of substantial dollars, and as mentioned, $80 million for Louisiana, between $70 and $80 million, how are they making up for the loss of those dollars?
I'm not sure. This really isn't my area of expertise, but it is an issue that the Grange has worked heavily on. The states who didn't or who received and refused the universal service money, I'm not sure how they intend to make up the gap.
Well, the sentiment expressed by Bren, who called a moment ago, I'm sure he's not alone. Some people say, look, this is a waste of money. We've got this huge deficit, a spiraling debt. We've got to cut somewhere. This is a good place to start. Your response?
This is definitely not a good place to start. What I consider to be my overall job is to bring rural Americans the resources they require to stay in rural America and continue growing food. We've been fighting what we call brain drain for years, whereas kids, you know, in their teens and 20s, they don't want to farm, so they leave these areas to go to big urban cities, and there's no one left to continue growing food in rural America. And the sooner that we can get all of these people the resources they need to stay competitive with urban America, the better off our food supply is going to be, more plentiful and sustainable.
We have well over 300 million people in the United States now, over 7 billion in the world, and farmers continue to do their thing. And if they didn't, we'd have some real issues. How difficult is it to feed the world today?
Pretty difficult. We're supposed to surpass 9 billion in the world by 2050 at least, which means that we're going to have to grow as much food between then and now as we have in the last 100 years or more. It's a challenge, and one that I don't think we could accomplish without genetic engineering, also known as GMOs, or what they create, which is becoming a really controversial issue, but I think it's essential and something that we definitely need to fight for.
297-5633. We go to LSU and Bridget. Bridget, you're on with Grace Boatwright.
Good morning, and I greatly appreciate your guest on the show this morning. I just wanted to point out to the previous caller, and perhaps your guest can expound on this, that history has shown that our government has been involved with increasing economic activities in this country since markedly after the Civil War. And that was done through putting much money into the development of railroads, which would help link not only the country, but economic activity between the West and the East. And so if people would learn more history, perhaps they would be less inclined to say government is bad and government has no business involved in economic activity, when in fact it has been for over 100 years documented, and the fruits of that have been fabulous, the production of the kind of economic growth we've seen in this country for over 100 years. And that's my comment. Thank you.
Grace, would you like to respond?
I'll refer that to you, Jim.
Well, we're at a stage where we have to think outside the box to feed the world, and there's still people, lots of people, millions of people who are starving and in parts of the world. Genetic engineering, you think this is something that is an important, essential endeavor. Why so?
Well, it's allowed us to grow not just more food, but better food at a much reduced cost, which is becoming ever more important as fewer and fewer people are involved in agriculture. But it's not just about growing more food, like I said, but better food. We can now breed crops to be resistant to pests and diseases and environmental stresses like drought. We can breed cattle to be resistant to mad cow disease. And
hold on. We'll be back with Grace Boatwright, National Legislative Director for The Grange, back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane is producing. 877-217-5757 if you're outside the Baton Rouge area, and if you're calling locally, 297-5633. As always, you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We resume our conversation with Grace Boatwright. She is the legislative director for the National Grange, an organization that's been around since 1867. Why did it take so long to get a farm bill?
Let's see. The real answer, I suppose, would be that nobody wanted to cut food stamps in an election year, which is why it's 2 years overdue. I'd say the biggest holdup would be the food stamp program, SNAP, and the fact that they were dramatically reforming crop insurance programs.
Politics and farming.
That's right.
Yeah, and like most everything else in American life, it has to be factored. And because of that, do you think you're going to have an annual squabble mm-hmm. over this kind of bill?
I hope not. I hope not. The fact that the Farm Bill is a $1 trillion piece of legislation doesn't help either. Nobody, you know, with the deficit running wild, nobody wants to touch a $1 trillion piece of legislation today. But I think that, you know, I think it'll get easier with time now that we're working out some of these old, outdated programs like direct payments. I hope that the next Farm Bill won't be so excruciating.
What can be done to tweak the process
of drafting and passing a Farm Bill?
Yes.
That's not so easily answered. I think a lot of people are trying to make the argument to remove the SNAP portion from the food stamp portion from the Farm Bill, which takes up about 80% of its spending. I'm kind of neutral on that matter. I see both sides of that debate, but there could be no doubt that if you did, you know, remove the food stamp component, that I think it wouldn't be so, that would only be about a $200 billion bill instead of a $1 trillion bill, so that might actually go over better on the Hill.
Well, it's a process that took a very long time to get to the finish line, and it also seems that depending on party affiliation, points of view are set in stone. There aren't many who go off the ranch on the food stamp issue.
Well, it's not a perfect bill by any means, the one that just passed, but I'm of the opinion that half a pie is better than no pie at all, and at least now we have something to work with.
Well, we thank you for joining us today. Grace Boatwright.
Thank you for having me on. It's been great.
It's good to talk with you, Legislative Director for the National Grange. It's a pleasure.
Take care,
Grace. We're joined now by Roman Kuznarek. He is a cultural thinker, writer, founding faculty member at the School of Life in London, and he is joining us from London. He has taught sociology and politics at Cambridge University, advises organizations, including the United Nations and Oxfam, on using empathy and conversation to create social change, and has been named by The Observer as one of Britain's leading lifestyle philosophers. His latest work is How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. And hello to you. I would say good morning, but I imagine it's evening.
It's just mid-afternoon, actually. Thanks for having me on the program.
Good to talk with you, Roman Kuznarek. Now, let's go to the Ralph Waldo Emerson quote, the 19th century writer, who said, "Do not be too timid and squeamish about your actions. All life is an experiment. The more experiments you make, the better." It sounds like he was a predecessor to you.
Well, I certainly take a lot of inspiration from him. And I think what Emerson was telling us, and this is one of the golden threads running through the history of everyday life, is that if you want to live the good life, if you want to feel like you've lived well, had a meaningful existence, that actually being experimental is something really important to do. And throughout history, there's really interesting figures who were experimental, and that's how they found a meaningful life. I mean, one that comes to mind is the famous Dutch painter Vincent van Gogh, who didn't start life as a painter. He experimented with lots of careers. He started out as an art dealer. He worked in a bookshop. He was an elementary school teacher, and he was even an evangelical preacher in the Belgian coal mines. And it wasn't until his late 20s that he discovered painting and drawing. So I think it's a lesson to all of us that we need to sometimes take a few chances if we're going to find the right path for ourselves.
But in his case, as in many others who test the limits, he was a bit of a tormented man, maybe more than a bit.
He was, and the reason I actually like mentioning him is because he didn't have a perfect life. He had a lot of mental health problems, and he, you know, didn't have a particularly good work-life balance either. But I think it's very realistic that I think we're all struggling, aren't we? We're struggling to make our relationships work, to get happiness from our jobs. And nothing's ever perfect. So I think it's a bit too easy to pick perfect figures from the past. And my book I've written really is about what history can teach us about everyday life. You know, what can you get from not just looking at things like psychology or philosophy or religion, but what can you look from get from looking at everyday life through the lens of the past.
And you go into the passions of life. For example, love. What, that's the first chapter. What can we learn from philosophers of the past about love?
Well, it's funny. Love's one of those things you can't. You sort of think, well, what could, for example, the ancient Greeks 3,000 years ago really teach us about love? And the answer is an enormous amount, especially with Valentine's Day coming up. I mean, we tend to use this one word, love, for so many different things. We'll whisper, I love you, over a romantic meal, and then sign an email the next morning, lots of love. But the ancient Greeks, for instance, would have thought that was incredibly unsophisticated because they had six different words for love, which I think we should try and recover and use today. So they had a word for sexual passion, which was eros. They had a word for deep friendships, where you'd sacrifice for somebody. That was the word philia, which is kind of the opposite of our quite superficial Facebook friendships today. They had another word for playful love and mature love and a healthy kind of self-love and even selfless love, the love of strangers. And the Greeks thought we should tap into all these different kinds of love with different people at different points in our lives. That's how to live a really full love life.
Talking with the British philosopher Roman Kosnarek, his book is How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. What about work? We had a guest a few moments ago, I thought had an interesting observation. He says usually in a place, 20% of the people do 80% of the work. What about work is a part of our life that is vital and makes us who we are?
Of course, work is such an important topic, partly because job dissatisfaction is at record levels in the United States at the moment. Only 45% of people are happy in their jobs. And, you know, just a decade or two ago, that was up at about 60%. So more and more people care about this. And the real question is, well, if you are thinking about changing careers, if you're trying to find more fulfillment, what can you do? And the lesson from looking through history is that you have to do the opposite of what almost all careers advisors tell you. The classic career advice for the last 100 years has been to do what's called the plan and implement model of career change, where you do lots of research into new industries and professions, and then you maybe do some psychometric tests, then you start sending out your resume, your curriculum vitae, and you try and find the perfect job that way. But in fact, the evidence shows if you want to find fulfillment, you have to do the opposite. Instead of thinking first and acting later, you need to act first and think afterwards. And that's about trying to do experiments with your career, like Vincent van Gogh, who I just mentioned. You know, trying to do work shadowing, volunteering, all these things, because we need experiential learning. That's the only way to really do it. So, you know, if you're an unhappy accountant or school teacher, you need to try and do some experiments on the weekends or in the evenings and act first, think afterwards, and that'll be the path, most likely path, to a bit more career satisfaction.
You also comment on two things that are considered to be vital for quality of life, time and money.
Yeah, time's a really interesting one. I mean, if anybody listening looks down at their wrist, they've probably got a watch on. Or they've got the time on their cell phone, on the computer screen in the corner, on their microwave ovens. We're surrounded by time, and we're obsessed with it. You know, 25% of Americans say they're constantly rushed, and that's a figure that goes up to 40% for single mothers. But actually, if you look through history, we weren't so obsessed with time. And in fact, our obsession is a kind of modern invention. And if you know about the history, I think it's liberating. Leonardo da Vinci, when he was painting The Last Supper, wasn't constantly looking at his watch or his electronic calendar, right? you know, back in medieval times, clocks used to only chime once an hour. It wasn't until 1800 that they had minute hands. Sorry, 1700 they had minute hands, and 1800 they had second hands. Then you had the era of clocking in factories, and then the wristwatch came in about 1880. And we've gradually handcuffed ourselves to the time. And I think we ought to all go on chronological diets and experiment with at least spending a weekend getting rid of your watch and not looking at a clock. And it could be a complete disaster, but my guess is it'll be strangely liberating for a lot of people.
Your final chapter is that we often do not reflect on death because we don't want to. And you write that death is more distant from the Western mind today than at any point in history, partly due to the breathtaking increase in longevity across industrialized nations over the last century. If you had been born in England in the 1830s, you would have likely lived on an average to the age of 38. 38. Now, today, people who are 38 think they're just getting started. People who are 58 probably don't think a whole lot about death unless they have some dreadful illness. When should we start contemplating on how we exit this world?
Well, I think that we are very afraid of talking about death in the same way we were afraid of talking about sex in the 19th century. And I think it would be a good thing if all of us started talking more about death. Back a couple of hundred years ago, when death was more around us all the time, death was part of a healthy conversation. But we have sidelined it. You know, a lot of children, for example, don't see death very much. I mean, because most people die in hospitals, you know, where they can't be seen. But this wasn't the case in the past. And a lot of people, they sort of think, well, children shouldn't be invited to funerals, for example. But there's still lots of cultures around where death is part of everyday life. Go to the New Orleans jazz funerals. Go to Day of the Dead festivities in Mexico in early November. And I think you'll see quite a healthy death culture where people recognize that death is part of our lives. And what I think the historical evidence shows is that if you seriously understand the shortness of life, that death is a reality, and don't try and hide from it, it actually makes you live with more passion and intensity. And I think ultimately that's a good thing because, you know, who wants to get to the end of their life and look back at regret for, you know, having stayed in the same job unhappily for 40 years? I think if we recognize that death is real, that it's going to keep us a little bit more on our toes.
Mm-hmm. Should we embrace it?
Oh, yeah, we should definitely embrace it. In fact, that last chapter of the book is called Not Death, but Death Style, because I think, you know, just like newspapers and magazines have lifestyle sections, I think they should have death style sections too, which what I mean by death style is the art of growing old and facing your mortality and dying well. And I think that's something we should definitely embrace and be talking about at dinner parties, as well as what's happening with the sport and the weather and where you're going on vacation.
I'm with you.
Oh, good.
And one thing is certain, that anybody who's listening to this interview is closer to death now than they were when the interview began.
Only about 10 minutes closer, but yeah.
Well, the Financial Times says of Roman Kaczmarek's book, How Should We Live?, a fascinating rattle bag of intelligent, stimulating essays on everything from work to love, time to empathy, by taking the long view to debunk some myths of modern life. Kaczmarek frees us from passing trends to answer the fundamental question, how should we live now? And most of us, I think, enjoy life, but we can always find ways to savor it even more. Thank you, Roman Kaczmarek, for joining us today from London.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Our pleasure. Take care. Tomorrow, by the way, we are slated to hear from the president of Louisiana State University, His Honor King Alexander, and of course he's a busy man and has a big job, and we'll find out from him the state of affairs at the Old War School. LSU's football team is savoring a successful recruiting season. Yesterday was National Signing Day, and the Tigers snared the number one player in the country in running back Leonard Fournette of St. Aug in New Orleans. And LSU is ranked second nationally in its recruiting class for 2014 to, surprise, surprise, the University of Alabama and Nick Saban. But Les Miles does not shy away from the plaudits given to him and his staff for assembling these fine recruits. He says that this group should mean that LSU competes for multiple national championships. So he has not shied away from the expectations. Tonight is the final night for Jay Leno as host of The Tonight Show after nearly 22 years. And he has been at the top of his game for most of those 22 years, rarely falling behind David Letterman in the ratings. And Jay Leno is 63 years old. And he will surrender the mantle to a 39-year-old successor, Jimmy Fallon, and he has gracefully passed the mantle to Fallon, unlike Johnny Carson, who ignored Mr. Leno because he wanted David Letterman to succeed him. And it's a time for remembering some of the great moments in late night programming over the last 22 years, since 1992, when Jay Leno succeeded Johnny Carson. I did want to read a note from Leslie Todd about our first guest, Tom North. She says, Mr. North is correct. The child abuse is common. The predator usually targets more than one child. Siblings and step-siblings are often the abusers. One of the consequences of the frequent repartnering today is that children are exposed to multiple adults and children who might abuse them. Another unfortunate consequence is there are many false allegations of sexual abuse made in custody disputes. It's an extremely difficult subject. Not only does CASA deal with this, but also the Baton Rouge Child Advocacy Center. That from Leslie Todd. And we thank you for joining us today. Back tomorrow for J.C. Kane. I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.